We just heard a snippet of Want Some Blues, which was a piece that was made for the 2020 Festival of Sound. And it celebrates the time when this special spot, the island of Thanet, was indeed still an island, and more of that later. Hello, I'm Jackie Ansell, and I'm an art historian, writer on heritage, history, art history, but most importantly, a long-term Ramsgate resident. I love this place. I love living here. I love the natural environment, the built environment. It's absolutely bursting with listed buildings. It's also got this geology, and which makes it really fascinating, and the geology that dictates a sort of cultural history. I'm sitting here on Ramsgate's West Cliff at the junction of Grange Road and St Augustine's Road. To the right of me is expanse of green, the esplanade where you can walk and you can talk, you can promenade, you can parade. Those are the themes of the next podcast. In front of me, the Lookout Cafe, and beyond that, the sea, and beyond that, France, which I can even see today. You can't always see it, but I can see it today. So we're doing this series of podcasts to celebrate the fact that Ramsgate has been recognised in 2017 as the first of Historic England's Heritage Action Zones, and that means scholarly reports have been produced on the history and heritage of this area. And my job is to bring you along with me on a walk through time to think about that history and bring it alive. And one of the people I've enlisted to help me on my journey is Sandra Silver. She's a Blue Badge guide. That means she's a qualified tourist guide, and she started to run real tours from the Lookout Cafe. She's a great enthusiast for Pugin, Edward Pugin, and Augustus Welby Pugin, his more famous father. And as I sit here, I'm looking up at a Grade 1 listed building, which is called Pugin's Grange. And this is the family home that he chose to build for himself in Ramsgate, a place that he'd visited, a place where his aunt lived, a place that he loved. And he had the most extraordinary life. But before we talk about that, who was he? You've heard of Big Ben. You can imagine the Houses of Parliament. You've seen the clock tower which houses Big Ben. And he designed that, as well as some of the interiors of the House of Lords. So he deserves to be celebrated. I asked Sandra Silver what we should be celebrating and why it was that he placed his house on this particular spot. And she gave me some very, very good facts and figures. He was born in 1812, same year as Dickens. He dies in 1852, which is a year after the Great Exhibition. And he exhibited work at the Great Exhibition. When he dies in 1852, he's only 40 years old. But in his lifetime, he crams in so much. I mean, he built 65 churches, 6 cathedrals. By the age of 19, he'd been orphaned, shipwrecked, bankrupt, and widowed. In fact, he was widowed twice. I'll leave it to Sandra to take on that story for you.
Everything he did was driven by faith, and this was where St. Augustine arrived in the 6th century. He converted to Catholicism in his 30s, and he saw, through Gothic architecture, an almost feverish mission to express it through his beliefs. And I think he didn't like the big cities and what the industrialisation of Britain was doing to the towns and cities at the time, the mills, the slums. And he had a mission. He called upon the 19th century, the cities of the 19th century, to redeem themselves by rebuilding in everything Gothic, because he thought that was the best way to express spirituality.
So in a way then, he is shaped by his vision of the past that's making him want to create a different future?
Absolutely. That's exactly what he did. Yeah, he was shaped by his view of the past, the medieval world.
Augustus Welby Northmore Pugin took as his emblem a martin bird, which is, if you think about a house martin or a swift. And his martin bird had no feet, because it didn't need to land, because it worked so tirelessly, worked himself to death, some people think. And if you want to visit him, you can see that he not only lived here, but he also is buried here, or rather in the church that he built adjacent to his Grange house. And you can go and also visit the remains of St. Augustine, so it's a very important site of pilgrimage. We're used to a sort of a regular facade, but at the time he was building this in the 1840s, the norm was classicism. I do wonder, though, how he found this novel design that had the kitchen at its hearth, and instead of relegating the children and their rooms to the very top of a tower-like townhouse, he had the nurseries on the second floor, or the first floor rather, so the ground floor. He's got a library, he's got his study where he can look out to sea, he's got a chapel because he's deeply religious, and he's built the church next door, St. Augustine's church, and his son will carry on his good work and make St. Augustine's opposite a place of quiet retreat and contemplation. But I think that the sound environment in his newfangled layout of his house was not perhaps what he quite desired. There's a wonderful quote when he says that he's trying to work and he rather wishes that he'd put the nurseries further from the study because the sound is akin to a pig pen with all the squealing of the children. I mean, he does seem to have been a very fond father of the 8 children, and he enjoys playing storms with them and chasing them around, and you can imagine their squeals of delight, can't you? And you can also imagine the sound environment outside the Grange, because I'm sitting actually somewhere called Screaming Alley, to the edge of Government Acre. And Government Acre is a large expanse of ground where the troops, the Napoleonic troops, would gather. In fact, most of Ramsgate was dedicated to the Napoleonic wars, and military occupation was very, very important in the history of this area, or rather defending from invaders. So why is it called Screaming Alley? Well, if you've got troops, you've got troop followers, camp followers. And some people say it was the screams of delight of the ladies who followed the red coats. Others say there's a rather gory story of a horse and cart that went straight on instead of turning to the left there and went over the cliff. I don't know if I believe that story. And then others say it was named after the children who would taunt Pugin, because he's built himself this magnificent house. He's built this great big wall to enclose his lovely garden and to keep himself secluded from the people of Ramsgate. But what he can't help is the noise of the holiday makers and their entertainers. There are brass bands, there are nannies walking up and down with their little charges. Screaming Alley is indeed quite noisy. I'm walking towards the Lookout Cafe, and in front of me the sea is a wonderful blend of azure, blue, lots of sparkle on the sea today. It's always different. It doesn't matter what the weather is, it's always spectacular. And this is a fabulous place to look out and look at the sea and see the landscape below, because we're looking down to the artificial beach. And that was created in the 1950s. Specifically for people to enjoy the facilities. There aren't so many facilities now, but it's still enjoyed by mostly locals, actually. It's a bit of our little seek bit, this Western Undercliff. I joined Sandra here, and I asked her what she saw when she looked out to sea, what she liked to tell people about the history of this wonderful place.
Well, I talk about the importance of the early invasions and how they've shaped our culture and our history today. And the things that are still here to remind us of it. I mean, we've got the two earliest Roman forts in Britain, which are still here at Richborough and Reculver. We've got the symbolism in the shield, the white horse of Kent, which is a symbol of the Viking invasions and the coming of the Saxons. We've got other reminders like St. Augustine's cross with the arrival of early Christianity, the Roman connection, the Roman-Christian connection.
And can you explain to me what you mean by English history started here?
Well, because so many key events that shaped us began here, and they all began with the crossing of the sea. They all began with that tiny stretch of sea from here to France is 35 miles from the Isle of Thanet. From Dover, it's only 25. But that tiny stretch of sea has been, you know, the beginning of all our history.
And what do you imagine when you look out to the sea?
Well, the first thing I imagine are the Romans coming in their long galleons, over 100 feet long, arriving in 53 BC with Julius Caesar on board, coming to do a recce to claim another part of the Roman Empire to increase their colonies. And it was just an astonishing arrival, because after the first landing, they didn't stay for long. They came back 100 years later and they stayed here for 400 years.
So what sort of vessels do you see in your mind's eye?
You know, the vessels that you see in the movies of the Roman galleons arriving in their boats of war and conquest. Of course, they didn't know what was here when they first came. They met the early Britain tribes, British tribes. Remember, it was in the Iron Age. And maybe their first approach to these cliffs wasn't as we see them today, all white and shiny. It would have been more heavily wooded and overgrown and heavily forested. And they were probably met, some of these early Britons, traversing the waters in coracles. And they themselves, the early Britons, would have been astonished at the landing of the Romans. Absolutely astonished.
Absolutely. And do you feel that people are astonished at the Roman history? Do they know about it, the people that you meet on your tours?
I think we tend to forget their influence and what they actually did and how they stayed here so long. Because they were here for over 400 years, and that was one hell of a long occupation. But they brought us many good things.
And what do you think is special about Pegwell Bay, you mentioned? Why do you think they landed here?
Well, the topography of the landscape, it's a wide natural bay, and it just looks that strategically placed, it would be a perfect landing spot.
And were they the only people to land?
No, they weren't, because after them came the Saxons. And they obviously probably chose the same site for the same reasons. And spread out eventually to create their own kingdoms and occupy different territories around England. But at the time of those two invasions, this was still an island off an island.
The Lookout is a wonderful place to stop and stare out to sea. But it's also the starting point for the real tours that Sandra takes you on. And they go towards the town, but we're going to head away from the town now. We're going to go towards Pegwell Bay, along the top of the cliff, towards the boating pool, which is a wonderful venue that was laid out for the people of Ramsgate in the 1920s. You can hear that this is a very popular spot for people to walk their dogs. There's a runner just going past, and a cyclist. We've now got these new markings, so everybody's in their correct lanes and there's no accidents. I'm going to take us now walking towards the boating pool. Come with me and think about the fact that we are walking along what's known not only as the Saxon Shore Way, but also the Viking Trail. So our history is very evident, even in the signposting around us. In the distance, I can see a curious sculpture of hands and molecules. And on the distant horizon, you can see what was Pfizer's. It used to be a major employer in this town. So let's just have a look out to sea. Let's just recap on what we were just told by Sandra. Because looking out, you can see on the horizon Deal Pier. It sort of emphatically marks that horizon and the first spot where the Romans landed in 55 BC. And then your eye sweeps along and it's caught by this very golden strip of sand. We've got Sandwich Bay, which is now a nature reserve. And as you come nearer into the shore, On some days when the light's just right, you can see Richborough Roman Fort. So you're so aware of this landscape that lives with history, this very ancient history. And I'm walking towards a bit of new history, if you like, this sculpture. And as I do so, I'm going to be thinking about the people who've walked before me, the promenaders that we're going to be talking about in the second podcast. I'm sitting here at the boating pool with a wonderful smell of pizza reaching my nose, and I can just about hear people chatting and enjoying one another's company, because it's now a pub called the Ravensgate Arms. And Ravensgate takes us right back to that ancient history when people thought that Ramsgate might have been a corruption of that name. It's a wonderful place just to sit and look out to sea. And the pool in the middle of the two semicircular buildings, it almost looks like an infinity pool. And you can imagine generations of people before you have sat there, but they wouldn't have looked at a boating pool, they would have looked at a bandstand, and they would have heard the wonderful sounds of music that made the seaside holiday more enjoyable and entertained the locals as they promenaded on this esplanade. I've come to the boating pool because it's a very nice place to stop and have a drink, but also it's somewhere that you can get to by car, by coach. If you don't fancy a walk or you can't walk, you can sit here and you can just look out to sea and enjoy the whole environment. Locals will know it as the Monkey House, because in the 1970s there were monkeys here. It was a little menagerie. I've come here today because it's the site of an artwork, or it was the site of an artwork that was in the Festival of Sound last year, and I invited the artwork's creators, Nick Page and Ruth Rollison, to talk to me about it and their work that was called Island Off Island. And you heard a little bit of Nick Page's composition at the beginning of the programme. So Nick, at the beginning of the programme we heard a piece that you had written about the Wantsum. Can you tell me what's special about the Wantsum for you?
Well, the Wantsum is what defines Thanet. It was a waterway that was once a mile wide. It created a safe route into the mainland because it joined up with the River Stour. You could navigate up to Canterbury, and the last significant navigation was Henry VIII taking his fleet up there. It is something which we all know about, and it is now gone, but it remains as a trace. So it's lost, but it's possible that it will come up again. And when you cross it, you do feel yourself coming into a different space. Thanet is very different in feel to the rest of Kent. I grew up in West Kent, so I know how different it is to that. So it's a mythology, really.
Could you tell us a bit more about how you came to create that and the mood that it evokes?
Well, mood is the right word. I wanted to create a piece that evoked how Thanet feels to me as a person who experiences it and lives in it. It can at times be quite bleak and quite desolate, and other times quite beautiful. So I wanted to approach them from two levels. One is to create a sound which evokes that feeling. So for that purpose I used a slide guitar with a sort of bluesy feel, which has I used a tuning which makes it slightly melancholy. But to accompany that, the rhythm was created literally from the physical nature of the island. So it was created by stamping on flint, hitting chalk with a hammer, and recording the sound of the sea breaking onto the shore. They are edited to make them useful as a rhythm, but that sound comes from there. I like to use field recordings because that gives you the essence of the place, the actuality of the place.
What did your piece look like?
I created drops of handmade paper that were interspersed with letter shapes, which made the words up of different letters and phrases for Thanet. And when the light shone behind them, I could see the words. And then over the top of those, I wrote on some large sheets of cellophane using different calligraphic hands, which resonated with different time periods of Thanet, and with those I wrote different stories that you could just make out, but it was more of a feeling that I wanted to impart.
And I think it's very interesting that your piece made clear, because you had a series of sort of little facts just to really excite people's imagination. One of the facts that I really enjoyed was the idea of having extant Roman remains. You know, we've got Richborough at one end of the Wantsum, we've got Reculver at the other, and we can actually see those things. And it's not always obvious, is it? The very, very ancient history is the history that's been buried and overlaid by the new technology, as you've pointed out, Ruth.
They're the boundary markers of the channel that defines the island.
So many people feel there's something special about Thanet. Is that something you feel, having grown up here, Ruth?
Yes, I do. I don't think I necessarily felt it when I was really tiny, but as I've got older, and certainly when I was on the beach, I only spent loads of time on the beach, then that was a very special place. But yeah, definitely. When I come back to Ramsgate after being away and see that sign saying Ramsgate, it definitely stirs something in my heart. An excitement and a joy knowing that I'm back to the sea, back to Thanet.
And back to the edge of the English coast. You know, you can't go any further.
No.
Which brings us back to your notion of island off island.
When you rise up, you come into the channel of the Wantsum, even though the actual river's only a few feet wide. But you come in on that level, which was once a seabed, and then you rise up, and as you rise up, particularly at night, you're conscious that there's not very much more in front of you. It's the end. You are on the end of the country, and beyond that is emptiness.
And I'm wondering how much of that is determined by the geology, this feeling of emptiness.
Yes, I think so, because of that flatness, because that's what the river, where the river Wantsum would have been. But what I love also is seeing that little crop of white chalk as approaching Pegwell, and that's where the isle becomes itself, becomes its own, a little outcrop jutting out. And there is nothing else. And that's that peninsula, which I think is very special.
And I think there's something special about the high ground on the island. You were telling me about different burial practices.
Yes. Well, Manston is the highest part of the Isle of Thanet, and that's where historically people buried their dead, because because it was the highest point of the land, therefore the bodies wouldn't get contaminated by the rain. They'd stay dry, relatively. Manston, and it's interesting now, it's a runway, but because it is the highest point, I find that fascinating, that was once used as an area for burying people.
That's really interesting. Thanks very much, both of you.
We'll leave the balmy evening sounds of the boating pool behind us as we walk towards the seafront again, and it's a bit blustery as we get towards the cliff edge, but we're going to walk down a slope that will take us to the western undercliff. And you need to slightly retrace your steps, go left towards that hand and molecules again, and beware you don't get run over by any cyclists. Cross the swathe of green grass that takes you nearer to the sea, where you can walk and you can sit down on many of the benches. There's lots and lots of benches to help you to rest and look out to sea. So we're walking towards the slope, and I'll rejoin you then. I'm looking down onto the beach, and the beach is, as I said, artificial. It's kept there because it's got lots and lots of breakwaters. So it was built with sand that was taken from the main sands in the 1950s. And the sand has to be protected from the longshore drift and prevent it from just all disappearing again. So it's an ever-changing coastline, isn't it? It's obviously with every mood of the day different, and every tied different. It's just such a treat to see Ramsgate in its many moons and many moods. Just pausing to take in the scene here. There's a group of youths enjoying the scene with their cans of beer. There are some dogs and people on the beach. Dogs are allowed on this beach all summer, whereas on the main sands they're not. And there are even some people out to sea. There's somebody in a wetsuit there with a very colourful, bright, inflatable bag that serves as a float, but also so they can be seen. I'm walking down this slope and the smells of the flowers that have populated this chalk cliff is quite intense, and the colours as well. You've got yellows, you've got purples, you've got mallow, you've got thrift, all sorts of wonderful natural sights and sounds assail you, as well as the sounds of the more recent innovations like the cars, like the burger van that I can see in front of me. People in their camper vans come down for the day, and it's a very, very nice spot to sit and look and to walk. As you walk down the slope to the sea, if you're really lucky looking out to sea, you might see a seal. You're more likely to see a mermaid, or a mermaid as they're called. And to explain that, I asked Vivian Yanker to tell me more. And you can listen to that while I carry on walking down this slope.
Viv, could you tell me a bit about the mermaids?
Certainly. The mermaids started May last year out of the pandemic. And it was a group of three or four of us that were swimming regularly at the Western Undercliff Beach. And so I suggested a WhatsApp group just so that it was easier to ping a time and we'd all meet there. And from there, unwittingly, I've managed to produce this group of, I think it's 146 members now, or participants, who we might be swimming and somebody come up and say, oh, do you swim here often? And so we'd say, do you want to be on the group? And I'd put them on. Somebody would be in the sea swimming and you start talking to someone and, oh, do you want to be in the group? And so it grew and grew and grew. And we are a group of people, predominantly women, but not exclusively, that just love being in the sea, being part of the sea, and all that that gives us.
And what do you think it does give you?
Personally, it is the oneness with nature. I mean, I love being in nature anyway, walking in the woods, anywhere. But with being in the sea, you're actually immersed in it. You're totally part of it. And the power of that is just phenomenal. I can feel it. Sometimes I've gone down maybe feeling a bit weary, maybe a bit of a headache or a bit flat one day. And just as you start to walk in, as you go deeper and deeper, you can just feel everything just lifting and going.
And do you stop when the warm weather ends?
No. For the first time ever, I went through the winter.
Fantastic.
And I'm just totally addicted now. Totally. And in fact, at the moment, the water's feeling quite tepid. And not just me, actually. We're actually missing the colder water where it sort of zings your skin and sort of really brings you alive.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because the health-giving properties of the sea and the sea air are very much what Ramsgate has based its whole beginnings and development on, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
And I understand that you're an artist, so is there any way in which it's impacted on your practice?
Hugely. Well, more so for the last show I've just had. The coastal environment, or my personal environment, has always influenced, informed my work. It was the Highlands when I was spending a lot of time up there. And since I've moved to Ramsgate, the Thanet coastline, the chalkstones and flint, things like that have informed my work. But for the last show I had, Letus, I looked at the sand from the Western Undercliff beach that I swim from every day under a microscope, and that started a completely new journey, ending in this new body of work that is directly linked to the beach I swim from and what the swimming and the experience gives me as well through the shapes, textures, the glazes I use, and the sense of community, which is huge, from the mermaids, and also thinking about the sand that I was looking at, just one tiny grain of sand makes the body of sand, so that's a community of sand, and that just started me off on another thought, which will be another body of work that will happen next. So, yes, it's influenced my work hugely.
So watch this space. Yes. Inspired by this place.
Yes, absolutely, definitely.
I don't know if you can hear the roar of the traffic or the murmur of the sea more as we walk towards the sea level. You can always hear the seagulls though, can't you? I'm walking towards the port now, which has got, well, it's gone quiet recently. It used to have the Sally Line ferries going to and fro, and now it doesn't. Now it's just got the concrete batching plant. So for leisure purposes, we want to move away from that and double back on ourselves, and when we get to the end of the slope, we'll cross the road, we'll turn right, and we'll go towards Pegwell Bay. See, there's a group of eager sea swimmers, the mermaids on the beach. It's a lovely place where you can just go and talk to people, and you don't have to know people beforehand. You're just all united by your love of the place and space. And there's also people bent double looking for shells and fossils, and people just sitting and enjoying the sounds. And today, as well as the sound, you can enjoy the sunshine. Looks like a lovely day for a dip. We're walking on towards the end of this pavement, really as far as you can go, past the burger van, sometimes there, closed, past the lines of park cars. And on very cold days, you can see people sitting in their parked cars, looking at the world through the window, over the top of the thermos flask, stuffing their tea. But you have to bring your own tea if you want to come down here. We're very hardy on the Western Undercliff. It doesn't have those facilities that the main sands does. It used to have the most amazing beach huts. Very, very beautiful rows and rows of beach huts. One on top of another, very international style, very local bousier. And I remember them being taken down, and as the digger just ate into them, you could see all these beautiful interiors of retro-looking floral wallpaper. My son was very excited by the digger, but I was a bit sad by the loss of this little slice of seaside life. There are plenty of other places that do have that sort of facility. So in a way, there's something quite nice and almost a little bit desolate about the Western Undercliff. As you're walking, you look down onto the beach and you start to see what's called a wave-cut abrasion platform, I understand, if I can remember rightly from my geography lessons at school. Well, I mean, it looks like a pockmarked moonscape, really, and The white chalk is covered over with green slippery seaweed and mud. And if you're really lucky, you'll see some wading birds picking over the mud. Today I can just see two teenagers really enjoying exploring. It's pretty safe here because it's very, very shallow. This is the Pegwell Bay that Sandra was telling us about. The tide goes in a long way, goes out a long way, exposing this chalk bed, but also exposing mud flats where you can see birds. So I'm going to turn off now and I'm going to join you again when we get to the end of this little walk towards Pebble Bay. Well, I said I was going to pause, but I've instead decided I'm going to sit down and I'm going to look out to the sea and stop walking, keep talking. And I'm sitting above a man-made pool. It's very angular, a great big oblong pool that fills up with the sea. It's not really quite deep enough to swim in, but it is somewhere that when my children were little, we used to love to make boats and sail boats on this little pool. It's also a place that you often see people fishing for crabs with their baited lines, bacon on their lines. And as long as you put the crabs back again, then that's okay. We've got to protect our biodiversity. I can actually see some bubbles coming up from the pool, from the bottom of the pool. So there's all sorts of living creatures in there, I'm sure. Walking on. You can really smell the air here. You can smell the seaweed. It's not sort of smelly seaweed like you get at Margate. It's just really sort of bracing, really energising. And at Pegwell Bay itself, there's a tunnel that you can go down onto Pegwell Bay. It's a brick-lined tunnel, and that was used to be used where people were collecting seaweed from the beach. And I think we forget, really, what a valuable, nutritious foodstuff the seaweed was, not just for people, but also for the land. It's very good for nourishing the land. Passing a family with a fishing net. This makes me nostalgic. Wellies and fishing nets, that's what you need. All weathers, any time of the year. As Ruth said, really, there's nothing like just walking on this place, this strange liminal space, as Viv was talking about, this place that's neither land nor sea, the foreshore. I mean, it's sort of belongs to everyone and no one at the same time. I think technically it belongs to the Crown. See, there it was, a little boy recalling some memories of jumping over rocks. Every time you come, it's new, but it also reminds you of times you've come before. And it always promises a brand new experience, because it's always a brand new world that's revealed, isn't it? I mean, every rock pool there has got its long-term residents, but there's always somebody new who might arrive with the tide. You can see a little black-headed gull, very dainty, just perching on the waves there. I do like looking out to sea and seeing turnstones, red shanks with their red legs. You don't often see terns here, but of course the Sandwich Tern was named after Sandwich, you can see in the distance. I'm just passing a sign that says Sandwich and Pegwell Bay National Nature Reserve with access restrictions, and it tells us that this reserve is internationally important for wetland birds, many of which are vulnerable. And this area of salt marsh and mudflats have restricted access, so we really need to make sure that any dogs don't go running wild because they frighten the birds off. And further on, there's a seal colony as well, and the birds are feeding because they need to renew their energy, and every time they're frightened off, it may seem like a fun game for the dog, but it's not very good for the seals or the birds. So this is a triple SI. This is a really important landscape for the natural environment. I'm also just coming up to a tunnel that's reminding me of the built environment here, because you've got a tunnel dug through the chalk rocks. And I remember it being built. It's, again, very exciting. And that tunnel, if you use it, will take you from London Road right here. So if you do have mobility issues, if you are travelling by car, you can come right to the Western Undercliff and you can stop and you can take in the view. I'm just walking past two fishermen who are looking out to sea and enjoying the evening. It's a nice quiet spot, this, you can tell, can't you? I've just passed the road tunnel. So I said this could be a short walk. Well, it could be a really short walk, because what you could do is just park up at the Western Undercliff and just toddle along and come to the end here, walking towards the white cliffs of Pegwell Bay. And really, when you get to the end here, you can go no further. If you're able to, you can climb back up the cliff top to the cliff top on the paths designated for that purpose, and you can walk onto Pegwell Bay on the cliff top path. No less a person than Vincent van Gogh did that in 1876. I'm going to talk about him and his letters in the third podcast in this series. But I'm coming here because I want to talk to you about another artist, an important artist called William Dyce. Can you hear the oyster catchers? You can hear sort of peep, 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 high-pitched peep. And sound, because we're getting to the end here, we're at the end. Oh, I can see a beautiful curlew. They make the most mournful cry. It's just on the shoreline with its long curved beak, its downward curved beak. I can look up, the theme of this podcast being heaven and earth, I can look up and I can see just some very, very wispy clouds. We've got mare's tails, we've got a mackerel sky. And if you stand at this spot, you can actually see the sun going down. And you get the most beautiful sunsets here. The great artist J.M.W. Turner said the most beautiful skies in the whole of Europe are over the Isle of Thanet. I want to talk to you about Pegwell Bay, Kent, a recollection of October the 5th, 1858. And it was painted by William Dyce, who stayed here, presumably in 1858, and he exhibited the painting at the Royal Academy in 1860, and in 1862 in London, and in 1867 in Paris at the Universal Exhibition. So he really did put Pegwell Bay on the map. And I remember first seeing this painting at Tate Britain and thrilling with pride that this was somewhere that I knew and loved. And there's no exact view exactly the same as the view that Dyce painted, but in a way that's to be expected, the forces of erosion, etc. But he painted his wife, her sisters, their son William, probably about six at the time, and in the background of the painting you've got a man with a donkey, in the foreground of the painting you've got his family, and the women are bending down and they're inspecting the seashore very, very carefully, because they're looking for shells and presumably fossils. And in this chalk cliffs you can see layer upon layer of flint, and you're looking at layer upon layer of seabed. which I think is very thrilling and makes me think of, you know, a very, very deep time. For our theme of heaven and earth, we could think about the idea that in Dice's painting, in the sky, there's just the thin trail of a comet, Donati's comet. So he's looking up from the very particular spot of Pegwell Bay, but he's encouraging us to think beyond the particular, almost to the universal, making us think about man's place in the universe. And it's not surprising he's doing that, really, because think about the 1850s. We've got Charles Darwin, who was another visitor to Ramsgate. He came here for the good of his daughter's health. And he is writing, of course, an analysis that is going to really threaten the idea of the creation of the Earth and the timescale involved in the creation of the Earth. So here, at the end of our walk, at the end, as far as you can go, I'm bounded by a metal barrier here, I can't go any further. Let's just think about those enormous themes and the themes that are prompted by the HAZ report, the Heritage Action Zone report. And the author of that report, Jonathan Last, I'm going to give him the last word because he's recorded for us some of the stories that he uncovered, literally and metaphorically. We passed earlier the entrance to the tunnel, and he's going to talk to us about that.
Walking along the seafront, and it's relatively easy to imagine the recent history of the resort since so much 19th century architecture survives. But what about the earlier periods of Ramsgate's history, especially those prehistoric times before the town itself existed? Here, the visible history, those grand Victorian buildings, tend to get in the way. Our prehistoric story is only revealed by archaeological methods, survey and excavation on land that's being developed. So we know less about the historic core of the town and seafront than the suburbs, especially those areas on the edge of town where we find the new housing estates, retail and business parks, roads and roundabouts. So ironically, archaeology serves to reveal the deep past of the modern places which superficially appear to have least history. An example of the way archaeological work for development reveals deep history is the Royal Harbour Approach, which runs around the western side of town and emerges from its tunnel near the seafront. At the inland end of the tunnel, the road cuts through Chalk Hill, where 5,500 years ago, Neolithic people constructed a large enclosure made up of lengths of ditch with gaps or causeways between them. This was a place where early farming communities who had a pastoralist or transhuman lifestyle gathered periodically for ceremonies, feasts and exchanges marked by archaeological finds of pottery fragments, struck flint, animal bone and burnt grain. Unusually, however, this is not the only such gathering place in the vicinity. Up above us, between the Royal Esplanade and Pegwell Road, was another such enclosure, possibly open towards the sea. So Ramsgate may not exactly have been a seaside resort in the Neolithic, but it was clearly a place where people liked to come and gather. A little further along the Royal Esplanade, remains of a slightly later period came to light in 2002. This was a small Bronze Age burial mound marked by a circular ditch and a number of cremation burials in pots. The remains of these people were interred around 1400 BC, which comes towards the end of a period of several centuries when Thanet appears to have been something of a sacred island where people from a wide area, perhaps those who had certain status within the community, were brought for burial, the graves covered by earthen mounds or barrows. These barrows have nearly all been levelled now by centuries of agriculture, but aerial investigation has revealed the scale of this landscape of the dead, the barrows tending to cluster above the coastline or valleys leading to the sea. After the early Bronze Age, Thanet took on a rather different character. Rather than a place for the dead, it became a meeting place for seafarers plying the Atlantic sea routes between Spain and Scandinavia. We know this because scientific analysis of chemical isotopes in buried human remains can tell us about the geographical regions in which those people grew up. Discoveries at Cliffsend Farm, near Pegwell Bay, have revealed the ambivalent nature of interactions between locals and immigrants. On the one hand, we have evidence for feasting and conviviality. On the other, there are the burials of a number of people who had suffered violent injuries, perhaps even victims of human sacrifice. As an island, was Thanet an appropriately neutral place for negotiating potentially difficult relationships with foreigners? I will say nothing about Brexit here. I also want to mention one character who connects the developing resort of late Georgian Ramsgate with its deeper past. This is the creation geologist George Fairholme, who lived on Wellington Crescent during the 1830s. At a time when geological work, notably by Charles Lyell, was challenging scriptural narratives, Fairholme used careful observation of the cliffs around Ramsgate and their rates of erosion to calculate a starting point when it must first have become dry land. He estimated this was around 5,000 years ago and argued it must have been the result of Noah's flood. Fairholme may have been on the wrong side of the scientific argument, but his work shows how the debate around the age of the Earth was not just faith against reason, but was informed by science and scientific observation on both sides. Charles Darwin's brief holiday in Ramsgate a few years later has been marked by a blue plaque, while Fairholme's decade in the town is not publicly acknowledged. Such, I suppose, are the vagaries of intellectual advance.